And this is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. When words don't mean what they say, right to work? Well, right to work laws are anything but that. Wisconsin is the latest state to fall victim to the right-wing anti-union juggernaut. Right to work laws destroy unions. That's their real purpose. Right to work legislation isn't driven by a groundswell of disgruntled union members chafing under union oppression,
but by employers, industry associations, and lobbyists. Right to work laws drive down wages for everyone. We'll explore the history of right to work laws, who and what's driving this juggernaut in states across the nation, and what is to be done to challenge this race to the bottom. Our guests will be Kevin Grundlach, president of the South Central Labor Federation in Madison, Wisconsin, and Elizabeth Tandy Shermer, assistant professor of history at Loyola University and co-author with Nelson Lichtenstein of The Right and Labor in America. But first we're going to listen to a snippet by Governor Scott Walker at a conservative conference recently talking about the right to work, workers' demonstrations, terrorism, and ISIS, and why he is qualified to be President of the United States.
And just breaking, Wisconsin will become the 25th state in America that allows workers the freedom to choose whether they want to work for a company and be in a union or not. So how did we do that in a state that hasn't gone a state... Apparently, the protesters come from Wisconsin as well. But you know what? Those voices can't drown out the voices of the millions of Americans who want us to stand up for the hardworking taxpayers. As long as I'm a leader, I'll continue to do that going forward.
Governor Walker, Ned Ryan, American Majority, board member of the American Conservative Union. Should you become commander-in-chief, how would you deal with threats such as ISIS?
I want a commander-in-chief who will do everything in their power to ensure that the threat from radical Islamic terrorists do not wash up in American soil. We will have someone who leads and ultimately will send a message not only that we will protect American soil, but do not take this upon freedom-loving people anywhere else in the world. We need a leader with that kind of confidence. If I can take on 100,000 protesters, I can do the same across the world.
Well, that was Scott Walker, and I seem to be, Ken, on the speed dial of the... National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation. Again, words don't necessarily mean what they say. And I keep getting these smiley faces sent to me day by day by day, leading to the countdown where we lost Wisconsin effectively to right to work laws. But for people who don't understand what right to work means. I know people who think that it means, oh, that's great, right? Isn't that like full employment? Well, why don't our guests explain to us what right to work laws are and where they came from and why they're so successful in sweeping across the country? And who wants to begin?
I can start with...
And that's Elizabeth.
Sorry. You know, what they are, as you said, they're seemingly benign statutes that sound so positive. You know, the person has the right to work without any sort of... I'm going to mess up the exact quote of all these statutes. Statutes that you've seen since about the mid-1940s without any sort of worry about having to join a union. And really where these things come from is actually, oddly enough, though we like to think about this as sort of relatively new coming to the Midwest, they actually grew out of a labor peace act in 1939 passed in Wisconsin, which was actually a sort of template for the revisions to the National Labor Relations Act passed in 1947. That act, more commonly referred to as the Taft-Hartley Act, which allowed states to pass right-to-work laws, which they restricted the membership rules that unions could negotiate with their members. And unions used to negotiate something called a union shop, which was that if you were hired by an employer, you know, after a certain amount, if you remained an employee in good standing, you had to join the union and be a dues-paying member because you were protected by the contract. These right-to-work laws said that unions couldn't negotiate that anymore. And what you saw is that the first attempts to actually pass these laws, and they're very cleverly marketed, because in the time in the mid-40s, you actually heard FDR and later President Truman refer to the right to work as the right to a good job, meaning a unionized job or something like that. You saw them pass first in the American South and West. In 1944, we saw the first three statutes, or the ballot proposition going up, Arkansas and Florida, where they passed, California, where it failed. And then the first one in the West was actually in Arizona in 1946. This is the law that was actually heard before the Supreme Court to uphold that section of the Taft-Hartley Act pertaining to right-to-work laws, and that's where you saw a slew of them all across the country, these ballot initiatives to see if you could pass a right-to-work law. And they couldn't pass them, except in the American South and West. And it really was this extraordinary amount of money coming in, and a lot of this in the early post-war period. It's thought about making sure that you're guaranteeing returning veterans the right to work, things like that, all talked about patriotism and stuff like that. And it doesn't fly in the Midwest and the Northeast, where unions were much stronger. It passed in the American South and West and really kind of stagnated about in the mid-1950s, when you saw the creation of the National Right to Work Foundation that you discussed, trying to sort of protect this and carve out legislation in the late 50s and then onward. And then only recently how we saw them return, with New Hampshire passing one recently, and then, of course, the states in the Midwest.
So, Kevin, just to be more succinct about what the right to work law is, if I have it correctly, under this, people in the workplace do not have to join the union, but they are covered under the contract, and the union must service them. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. What it basically means is you get the benefits of the representation, you get the benefits of what everyone else that joins the union and pays their dues or fees, you get those same benefits that the people who are paying in receive. And what that means is if you can get something for free and, you know, you're struggling in a difficult economy, are you going to get it for free if you can? And some people will choose to do that. We saw that under Act 10 when it was implemented 4 years ago, specifically targeting public sector workers. And, of course, his famous conversation with a billionaire where she told him that, you know, the plan was to go to right to work someday. And, of course, he received the largest donation, a donor, $500,000 to his campaign from this billionaire. And that's what we're
seeing. One of the Koch brothers?
It was Diane Hendricks.
Oh, okay.
Of course, the Koch brothers have been spending a lot of money in Wisconsin as well. We know that. There's a lot of dark money even in our local elections for school boards and things of that nature. But one thing I'd like to say, though, is who actually doesn't want a right to work in Wisconsin? And, of course, union members don't want it. But there are a lot of other organizations that came up recently in the last few months, and these coalitions grew in large numbers. For example, the construction companies formed a coalition called the Wisconsin Contractor Coalition, and 400-plus local Wisconsin companies that work with the building trades unions came out against right to work, and they formed a coalition because of it. And those companies were ignored, and they came out because they saw a threat to the relationships with the workers. They thought it was a threat to the contracts that they agreed to. They did not agree with it. And remember, these people, a lot of them were supportive of the Republicans, and they are very upset. The other organization was the Wisconsin Business Alliance, which is a small business. There are a number of small businesses. They went out and checked with their local chambers of commerce throughout Wisconsin, and they couldn't find a single local chamber of commerce that said, yes, we want right to work. So the question is for Wisconsin, not only who's against it, which comes from the contractor coalitions, with small businesses, with workers, union and non-union alike, with local clergy. Many people came out against it. The question is, who's really for it? Because we, in the state of Wisconsin, and when we were going out door to door to talk to people, whether it was an election or not, and we went and talked to folks about what are the issues that are afflicting their neighborhoods and their communities and their workplace, we didn't get one answer from one person that said, we need right to work, those unions. And we were talking to people who were all over the place in Wisconsin, rural Wisconsin, small towns, large cities, and not one person said they wanted right to work. They said they needed better paying jobs, which is what right to work won't bring. And as we know, it's a $5,000 difference for a household. When they go to right to work, they're making $5,000 less on the average.
Kevin, one of the things that is of great interest to me, you talked about coalition, and certainly those of us in New York with great glee several years ago watched as thousands of people came out in Wisconsin, union workers, workers who understood the threat that was upon them and stood solid and aggressive for many days. Well, I just juxtapose that to how deep and wide the coalition is, because, after all, it did pass in Wisconsin. And one of the things I was thinking of and wondering about is Tony Robinson, a 19-year-old, was killed by the police in Madison this Friday at 6:30. And protests did break out immediately after, and they were students, and they've been growing. And high school students and middle school students walked out, and University of Wisconsin students also, all marching to the Capitol. Is there the kind of coalition that really held firm? And if so, how are we to understand this juggernaut that prevailed in Wisconsin? Or is there a coalition that is still very much divided along issues of race and issues?
Well, I think in anything, you've got to build a coalition. So I do believe that we've got a long way to go, but the important part is that these coalitions are popping up as these threats occur. And what we've done here in Wisconsin, throughout Wisconsin, with the AFL-CIO and regionally in our area, is setting up solidarity roundtables so you can have those first steps of communication between unions, and also going out in different areas and figuring out through the workers who their allies are and who their allies could be, and then what are those issues that are important to those shared interests. So I think what's happening is, as these attacks continue in various ways, and if you look at the budget, Walker's budget for Wisconsin is just devastating to almost every person out there. And I think that's where we're going to be able to build even a stronger coalition. But I do think we're in the midst of it. As many people know, sometimes organizations that are under attack react. I think there has been a lot of proactive things going on behind the scenes, which was educated in organizing the membership, which started 3-4 years ago on right to work, as well as other things. And I think that's the starting point that we have to build from.
Can I jump in there for a second? No one actually talks about is how many right to work laws have actually been appealed since they first started showing up. Because they have been. Actually, Indiana actually is a great case. Louisiana is another one. And then you see these things happening up west. And it's exactly as Kevin was saying, is it tends to be one that what stops right-to-work laws from being passed are these kinds of coalitions. And Kevin mentioned the clergy. The clergy were extraordinarily important in the case of New Mexico, which is now also just about to consider one as well. Case the Catholic Church in New Mexico, working with a lot of the miners in northern New Mexico. And then actually it's the coalitions together that also get these things repealed, which is exactly part of the story about what happens in Louisiana when they repeal their 1954 law. They end up doing something which is a little bit dangerous for the unions there, where they say that the right-to-work laws will only pertain to agricultural workers who already didn't have the federal guarantee because of how the National Labor Relations Act, the Wagner Act, was originally written. But it actually did actually bring them and connect with some businesses who were willing to have a sort of half right-to-work law. But it is those kinds of things that you can see, the coalitions, which actually pull these things back. And I think Kevin is actually right to note that I'm not surprised at all that you can find any real local support or demand for a right-to-work law, because the fact of the matter is what's really different in the Midwest about what's going on now, about how these things are being passed, is they're being passed in the legislature and signed into law by a governor, and that's why it's likely that Missouri won't get a right-to-work law, because the governor won't sign it into law, and it's been quite matter-of-fact about that. And they don't have the popular support, and this goes back to the gerrymandering that's been happening in recent decades, which makes it, you know, these state legislators very unrepresentative of actually what the voting population wants.
And real quick, just to talk about the gerrymandering here in this state, after gerrymandering and after the redistricting, which was, you should see some of these districts, the Republicans only needed 45% of the vote in 2012 to win 55% of the Senate seats, and only 48% of the vote to win 57% of our state assembly races. So we had the majority, but because of the redistricting that was certainly in favor of the anti-worker extremists who are now in power in Wisconsin and unwilling to even speak to folks, that's why we're at the point where we're at. And they fast-tracked this through. And the reason why they fast-tracked it through was for a number of reasons, and one of those was because they were worried about these coalitions that were going to start putting out TV ads and radio ads for the mainstream public.
Kevin, have you been following what's been happening in Indiana and in Michigan after the right to work was passed there, in terms especially of how the unions are doing and what kind of opposition they're giving?
Yeah, well, what we're looking at when I talk to our delegates and to the leadership in this regional area within Wisconsin, what we're encouraging people to do is go talk to your union folk in other right to work states, whether that be Iowa, Michigan, Indiana, wherever it is, and find out what they're doing to engage their membership, to organize their membership, to mobilize their membership. And you can gauge part of that, of course, with how many sign up and belong to their union, right? And, of course, how active they are. So what some of those locals have found is that some locals in, say, Michigan, they have, out of 300-plus workers, all signed up to join their union except two. And then in other places, for example, in Iowa, there could be one local that has very high sign-up rate and membership engaged and mobilized, and then another one, very, very low membership engagement and sign-up. So what we want to know is what are those locals doing from the very beginning in regards to the workplace and representation and mobilizing and organizing and engaging. And, for example, my local, which was public sector where I came out of rank and file, my local had about 200 members, and within a week, 96% of them signed up, and that was under Act 10, where they have very little to nothing to bargain over except a small wage increase. They don't get to bargain over workplace conditions or workplace safety, and that was very important to those folks. But the local leadership, which was rank and file, they were engaged with the membership, so much so that even when I moved on to this position, that it continued. And that's because there was a history of things that were done. And I think that's what's important for all of us to learn from each other. So talk to the folks in the public sector who went through this 4 years ago, which ones are doing better than others, why. Of course, some of that is the nature of their union, the nature of the work that they do. But we can learn from each other and then also go to these other states, like you mentioned, that are right-to-work states and learn from them. And I think that's the critical piece.
I think we should also get back to, because again, I'm not sure that people fully digest how things are being couched, or when they are being couched this way, buy into it. And again, I hate to return to, but will, the National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation. They claim that what this is about is the First Amendment right for Wisconsin private sector workers to refrain from union membership and dues payment, and that's what's long overdue, that this is coercion, that this is about the freedom of association. Why should somebody be forced to pay union dues or fees, and they say, to keep or to get a job? Elizabeth?
I mean, it's one of the right to work, that language, the right to work, has been there since the earliest usage of the phrase that we saw around the turn of the century. And the fact of the matter is that you have to pay your fair share. And even the Supreme Court decision that now seems under threat after Harris v. Quinn and the Friedrichs case coming up, Friedrichs versus California Teachers Association, the original Berger decision that upheld the what's called the fair share fee for public employee unions, you know, flat out said that this is actually not about the First Amendment. It doesn't actually infringe upon this. This is about keeping an organization going and paying into the union that actually is there to protect your wages, benefits, and working conditions. And therefore, I keep trying to sort of make this emphasize that this is the right to work is actually not just a labor issue. It's about the whole entire economic health of the state and the nation. Because, look, we do better as a country when the people who make things can actually afford to buy them, or the people who serve things can actually afford to go out and enjoy those services or use those services as well. And that's the key thing that this is all about, much less the fact that unions are also a tremendous way about getting the working class vote out there in an era where Republicans can spend so much money, right? When there's so much outside money coming into these state campaigns, it's actually unions, right, which are shoring up and protecting working Americans' ability to actually have their voice heard on election day, not just on the shop floor, but also to make sure that they can actually, you know, have a good standard of living. And that's what this is all about, and that's why these things we're doing. And it really has nothing to do about, you know, the First Amendment or the Freedom Association. In fact, when the labor movement actually tried to stop right to work when that Arizona case came before the Supreme Court in 1948, they tried to use the freedom of association argument about the union should have the choice to choose the freedom to associate with the types of folks, meaning that they would want to join the union. Didn't work. Didn't work. And, you know, when the labor movement tried to use it to their behalf. And actually, for me, the thing that's, you know, the most amazing thing about just how powerful and longstanding this is, you know, everyone, it is true that people want the right to work and the idea of freedom. But if you look at what a lot, I think it was one of the business groups around Scott Walker, you know, the first thing they sent out was about how this was something, you know, to stop those big labor bosses, right, those labor bosses from hurting workers and things like that. When is it that your boss became your union shop steward or something like that, as opposed to the actual person who employs you and can therefore fire you? It's absolutely ridiculous, and it actually happens a lot around the origins of the right to work laws in the very early campaigns. It's somehow, you know, business was able to sort of say that your actual boss was your other members of your union, as opposed to that.
Elizabeth, a lot of people in labor look at this as an existential threat, that unions themselves will be destroyed. But there have been some places in right-to-work states where unions have learned how to cope with this. I'm citing specifically the culinary unions in Las Vegas. You want to talk about what can be done?
Well, actually, and you know, the culinary workers are one of the great, you know, exceptions to the rule. And they actually had the benefit, and this is the sort of sorted side of the tale, where the culinary workers were really protected and strong is in Southern Nevada and Las Vegas. And when every 2 years there was something about the right to work on the ballot propositions, partly because the labor movement was so strong that they could keep bringing the issue back on the ballot and trying to get it appealed. And they really actually did a lot in Las Vegas. You know, Las Vegas, when you go there, it is a union town, and people have a real awareness that this is something that is there to make sure that if you actually have one of these casino jobs, you can actually have a good standard of living, and that the rest of Las Vegas actually benefits from that. But even in the state, actually, it was just funny when Kevin was talking, I was thinking about Arizona and particular Phoenix, because, you know, it's one of the first right-to-work states. It's in the West. And when I've been there, when I was doing research for my first book, it's actually, there are unions in Phoenix. There are unions in Arizona. And it wasn't just that they were good about sort of mobilizing their membership and getting the vote out on election day and cooperating with those efforts to bring folks in on election day to really, you know, beef up their power. But more importantly, those unions were actually engaged with the local community. And for me, that's what, as Kevin was saying about building coalitions, that's the most to not only stop right to work, but maybe perhaps even getting a repeal. Because thinking about, you know, the push to try and recall Walker a couple of years ago, it didn't work, but it was really pretty extraordinary. If you see that documentary, The Brothers Koch, there's a way that there's something to be done here, and I'm sure the labor movement is already working on that kind of thing.
Kevin, what do you think this really portends for the substance and integrity of the unions? First, it was the private sector unions that were being gone after by the right en masse, and now the public sector unions. Where are we at politically? Is this primarily about the ardent right-wingers like the Koch brother or groups like ALEC? What does it say about really fortifying, continuing, and the importance of organized labor?
Well, I'd just like to agree with the other speaker that community coalition building is critical and key to moving forward. I think that's what we've been doing. When I first got in a few years ago, we started reaching out to new communities and then also going out into the rural areas as well. So there were, I would say, neglected neighborhoods here in Madison where I'm located. And we reached out to a number of different clergy. We do have the Interfaith Coalition for Worker Justice that we have a tradition of working with, but we also reached out to the African American clergy and other, and we had a Latino Labor Forum, and we started having picnics at the Labor Temple and also inviting classrooms of children in. Some of those children decided to go on strike one day during recess.
I love it.
So we know that they're doing this on their own, of course, but we do know that with building those bridges, literally speaking, of course, iron workers and building trades do build bridges, and those bridges should be done safely and being done through apprenticeship programs, which are now threatened, but also building bridges in terms of with multiple different groups. And I think that's going to be where we're going to have to focus a lot of our efforts on. And as we do that with the internal organizing of our own members, and educating and mobilizing, and when I say mobilize, that's not just the electoral either, but also then building these bridges with community groups. And then the other things will come naturally when we have, say, a direct action, or we have a rally, or we put pressure on those who are against our communities and all workers. And that includes the electoral. So I think that's where we're going to have to go, because the money that's going to be spent in this state and other states and this country just during the electoral cycle, but also with the campaign that they're going to use to trick people into thinking what right to work is not and what it is. And I think that's where we're going to have to be doing a lot of one-to-one conversations and figuring out what we need to do outside of that as well.
And we're going to have to leave it there, but many mountains to climb before we rest. And Kevin Gundlach, president of the South Central Labor Federation in Madison, Wisconsin. Elizabeth Tandy Sherman, assistant professor of history at Loyola University. Many more things to be said. I hope you'll come back and we'll continue to build bridges.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.